तस्मै श्री गुरुवे नमः श्री चैतन्य मनोविष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूपकदामायं ददाति सापदन्तिकं वंशकौपाकरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभैव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासुदेवो भक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम हरे राम 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 हरे हरे।
Particularly, he felt that people were sincere. Does anyone know the Latin derivative of sincere and the history of the word? Joy, are you taking the class? Okay. Be real cocky. We want to get it all and take this. There's other people that want
it.
No, no. It goes off every 45 minutes.
So
you got a time?
Yes,
I'll be aware
of it.
Chloe's taping as well.
What?
Chloe,
yeah, I'm taping a
backup
as well, just
Thank
in case.
Thank you so much. Okay. It comes from the word Sarah means wax. And it's like sincere means, like sans means without wax. Now why is sincere without wax? The word comes from the time in the Renaissance where they were building beautiful temples. Now, I was in India when they were building the tomb of my guru out of the same place where they got the marble from the Taj Mahal. And the way it goes is there are people that stand around the mines, and when a piece comes up, the value of the piece depends on its clarity. If you get a piece that's completely white, you know, what if for some square foot or something, it may be $1,000. If it has a line in it, you know, it may be, you know, $500. If it's a little gray, it may be $250. So it's very hard. That's why the Taj Mahal is so, because it got only this incredibly white marble. So what happened is there was a run on marble in the Renaissance. So there's a very high price for marble that was only white, but there wasn't enough. So when there was a groove in it, and they needed to sell it, they would chop out the line and fill it with white wax. So that was okay when you sold it in the winter. But when the summer came, people realized that they were being cheated. So after a while, they wanted marble that was just marble. They wanted it without wax, sincere. So sincere means integrity. You know, he saw that you're here because you want to learn. You want to learn about bhakti. You want to improve yourself. It basically means without motive. Right? It means honest, clear, sincere. And it's actually one of the fundamental qualities of bhakti. Because bhakti is when you try to please, but not with any motive. Right? If someone does something for you, but, you know, they want something back, it's not sincere. Bhakti is when you want to please, and you want to please, and you want to please. And even if you don't get anything back, one of the highest verses in the bhakti tradition, especially from Chaitanya, is Ashlishava Adaratam Panastamam Adarshanam Mamahatam. You may make me brokenhearted by your embrace. You may crush me by your embrace. You may make me brokenhearted by not appearing before you, but I still love you, you know, birth after birth. There's no motive. And that's really what bhakti or devotion is, on the highest platform. But anyway, I do feel that, and I think you feel that among yourselves. You may not feel it about yourself, but you feel it among yourself. This is a very wonderful group that sincerely wants to learn and improve themselves in an open mind. Now, I spoke yesterday about how teaching goes on in dialectic, and that the biggest mistake someone can make is thinking that speaking the truth means that the truth is understood. And we see people who get up there and speak, and no one understands what they say except themselves. And they're speaking truth. Realization. This is a term. Realization. Deep understanding. Not just theoretical understanding. Means that you understand things deeply enough to package it for your audience understanding. When you don't have realization, you just repeat it like a parrot from what you heard from your teachers. Just let go. Let go. Or some mantra they give you. And you don't accommodate the frame of reference of your audience. You do one of two things. You just keep it in the same package, or you don't have realization. You try to communicate, you lose the initial essence and meaning of it. Someone who has realization can communicate. So part of that is dialectic. And dialectic means teacher has to be very cognizant of the student's frame of reference. And I very much appreciated that Gabriel asked those questions, because it really clued me in. What is lacking in the student's frame of reference? I'm talking about selflessness, and they're in the... What's the name of that fish that eats up everybody? Piranha? Piranic New York. It's not piranic like old. It's like dog eat dog. So, you know, this thing, how to become selfless, how to become... There's so many points we're there. So, I want to spend the first part of the class going over some of the points that I feel need to be clarified more. The first thing I wanted to do, I wanted to give this analogy. First of all, I have to say that bhakti is based on a particular understanding of the world. Every philosophy tries to understand who you are, what is yourself, and what is your proper relationship with the world or reality or existence. That's what we're trying to find out, because the proper relationship makes things work. And I gave the classic example, the proper relationship of the hand to the body is to serve the body. When the hand does it, it works. And what happens when it serves the body? It serves itself on the highest level. Because what the hand is a part of the body and meant for the service of the body. So in the same way, when we serve, and I have to say also that the clever thing is that whatever your conception is, I'm presenting what bhakti is. It's for you to accept or not. But the bhakti tradition is theistic. And I'm going to go over this also. That in the six Indian darshans, philosophies, predominantly they believe in the eternality of the soul, of who you are. It's not that in the future you disappear. If you disappear, there's no love. Love requires some kind of duality. It's not a duality. It's just like this. If I point to this, I can say this is my body. If I point to my knee, I can say this is my body. If I point to my mouth, it's my body. It's all my body. But the hand is not my mouth, and my mouth is not my knee. So we are intrinsically part of that absolute reality. And in one sense, without us, it's not the absolute reality because it's lacking something. We're intrinsically part. And even in the Yoga Sutras, and I've studied this very carefully, even in the Yoga Sutras, it's very, very clear that there's a Vishesha Purush, that there's a special soul that's inclusive of all other souls. It's very, very clear. It can't be more clear. And it has the same description of that absolute reality as the Bhagavad Gita, which also has that same conception. So this is what's called sambandha jnana. They feel that if you want to understand what is reality, understanding reality means to understand the relationship of things within reality. And basically there's three things. There's spirit or your soul, there's matter, and there's God or the divine. To understand properly the interrelationship between that, sambandha means relationship, means you understand reality. And if you don't understand it properly, you can't have bhakti. For example, what is the relationship between the soul and the body? Right? That's right. If you think you are the body, then you think you are the controller and the enjoyer. What's the question of bhakti? If you just think, I am the body, then you think, I am the enjoyer, I am the controller. If you think that the soul is God, rather than an intrinsic part of God, then what is the question of devotion? Devotion is an exchange. And if you think that God is a product of matter, then what's the question of devoting yourself to it? So this is called sambandha jnana. This type of understanding, it allows one to have devotion, bhakti. So whether you believe it or not, this is the basic foundation of devotion. And it's understood that the totality has a desire, because bhakti means to please. You please a desire. That the universe is a universal desire, and if you link with that universal desire, it's beneficial to everyone. And for example, it's universal principles. Of truthfulness or whatever you sense, universal laws, universal principles. If you do that, be assured it's good for everyone. Even in the battle of Kurukshetra, in the Bhagavad Gita, where Arjuna actually has to fight in the war, and somehow it's revealed, it's not jihad, it's very subtle, but somehow he has to protect from evil people. For example, I'll give an example right here. You know, let's say you're in the room and there's some small children and then some neo-Nazis come in. You know what I'm saying? And they got storm boots and they're about to... And let's say that you're a policeman right? Then you have to protect that. Right? That's your duty. That's what's right. That's what's correct. Even at the risk of great sacrifice for yourself. And if you're spiritual, you should do it out of love, because that is the universal. And if you do it, it's beneficial to everyone. Even the person who you have to apprehend. I'm just giving basic examples. So it's just like when the hand feeds the body, it's good for the whole body. Now, the question is, what about service to others?
Right.
Well, it's service to God. Right? For example, let's say they're kind of separate parts here. Here's one hand, here's another hand. Right? The hand serving the other hand is also serving the body. And it's really serving the body if it's connected to its function as a hand. You got that? We have a function, as Sri Vrindavan has mentioned, it's a spiritual function. So it's not that you don't take care of the professional stuff and the family stuff and the thing, but it's connected. Because when you do your duties properly, it allows you a certain peace and happiness that allows you to realize your true self. And that's the goal in yoga and Indian spirituality. It's all about realizing the self. And to do that, at every point you have to do dharma. Here's a very interesting definition of dharma. Okay? You have decisions to make. You remember Sri Vrindavan giving, he said, everything is decisions?
Mm-hmm.
It's true. In the Hito Pradesh, it's one book called Hito Pradesh, means instructions for welfare to do good. The first instructions is our decisions determine our fate or future. What we are now was determined by our decisions in the past. What will be in the future is determined by our decisions now. And you need two things to make a good decision: Gyan and Vairagya. You need knowledge and you need self-discipline. Because you have to know what to do, and you have to be able to do it. So in India, there's a whole science. You're faced with a decision. And it's not always the same, the answer, it's not always the answer is applicable to everyone. Because we're different people, we have different situations, we have different bodies, we have different genders, we have different desires, different natures. So we have to make decisions. So India has a system of making decisions called dharma. And it's sometimes very subtle. But if you make the appropriate decision, it will elevate your mind to a higher level of clarity and perception that will help you understand the soul, which is the goal. That's why in India there's such a emphasis on mentors. They're people that are supposed to understand and realize the traditions of application of principles to life and can see your situation and help guide you. Don't we all have situations where what to do, what to do, what to do? There is a choice, and the choice is, sometimes people make a thing, they tell a person what to do, but it's not individually geared to them. Indian philosophy is very practical. The decisions may be geared to you. He gave the different identities. We have to take care of them. But the appropriate decision will elevate your consciousness. And it has to be connected with love of the absolute reality. That desire of the absolute reality is that we become purified and realized, and that decision is connected. And bhakti means you'll do it with that objective. Even if it's to care for your own needs, it'll be done with that objective: love, devotion to the supreme absolute reality. So you take care of your own needs, but you're not independent. It's not you do what you want. That's not love. It's your needs. Just like the hand. You give the hand the food, right? Now, if the hand gets the idea it's independent and starts to try to enjoy the food, right? Then it's not acting in its interest and it's not acting in the interest of others. But if the hand repairs itself because the finger is broken, that's what the body wants. So it can be in connection with the body. So I really wanted to kind of clear that up. And therefore, in bhakti, there's a very interesting definition of renunciation. It's called yukta vairagya. Vairagya means dispassion, but it means balanced dispassion. And it means that you accept those things that can be used for service, and including your legitimate needs. And the renunciation is you give up other things. Because especially in bhakti, you can't atrophy the heart. Because vairagya, renunciation, means like this. No. 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 The heart becomes smaller and smaller. But you say no to those things that don't have application or use. Now I'll tell a story. I was very fortunate. Since I'm 61, and since I was 26, I lived in India, in Vrindavan. Most of the time, and recently I've been coming 6 months. So I met many, many sadhus and saintly people. So one time, I don't know what happened, but the ashram where I was served, it was a very big ashram, a new leadership came in. And they were almost militaristic. And because I was kind of, they wanted me, because I was kind of a leader there, so they wanted to give me kind of, it was almost like a sadhu uniform. You know, I was kind of walking around barefoot. They wanted to get me a pair of Birkenstock shoes, a Samsonite briefcase, my papers. And yeah, I don't know why they thought this was going to wipe. And then somehow they gave me a Rolex watch. You know? So anyway, it was insane. So anyway, somehow or other, I had this Rolex watch. You know? And I'll tell you a funny story. I hope it's funny. You'll be the judge. You know, Radhanath Swami is very, he's a good friend of mine. He's very traditional Indian sadhu. So he saw these Birkenstock shoes on me. He looked at them. And he said, how can you wear leather shoes? He said, the cows in Vrindavan, the cows are even more dear to Krishna than the Brahmins. Because, you know, I was, you know, that support after being in India for so many years, I got a little attached. You know, I said, they're actually, you know, they're synthetic. He said, but even if they look like that, and then I got so many foot injuries I threw them away. But then with this watch, I came to this learned sadhu in Vrindavan, this learned scholar. Very learned scholar. And I used to go, and I used to learn from him, and I used to ask him questions. He was like, you know, very learned. And then so I'd ask him this question, what is yukta vairagya? Balanced attachment. So here I have this Rolex watch. So I'm sitting there, and he says, 100 rupees is $2. Okay, so he says, yeah, just like you need a watch, 100 rupees. So balance. Balance. But balance is very simple. Understand? Very simple with that. What you need And again, what do you need in bhakti? You need to enjoy it. How much?
To live.
Not live to enjoy. You need to eat. How much? You don't live to eat.
You eat to live.
And bhakti is not renunciation. Yoga is renunciation. If you really want to be yogi, remember when Professor Bryant was here? He gave that class and he told somebody, he said, yoga is not for ladies in New York. If you actually understand what yoga means, bhakti is not renunciation, it's dedication. And therefore, in bhakti, you can be renounced. At the same time, you can keep something, but not the conception of possessiveness. And I think that was another point that was brought up. You know, when we talk about the selflessness and things, there's always a goal, there's always where we're at, and we proceed with humility. We don't debilitate ourselves with guilt. If we're moving forward, and there's karma yoga means what? You're attached to things, so there's a way to keep them where you can give the result of those activities and purify them. Like a person may be married and be making money, but then a certain percentage of the results is given in charitable activities to purify in that way. So I wanted to clear up these points, give you a little bit basis that really, you know, in any path you're talking that the goal is to find the self so you can be in harmony with the self. And yoga means a path to do that. And that, in a spiritual path, that's the objective, and everything is secondary to that. It doesn't mean it's not important. People have families. Vrindavan has a nice family. You know, you can, people can be businessmen. They can make money. Whatever the thing is. But it's secondary to that. The goal is that. And you do these things because it supports the goal. And if it doesn't support the goal, you give them up. But part of it is your social, physical, mental needs. Needs. Watch 100 movies.
So I'm hoping someone else asks a question so I don't dominate.
This is your saver.
This is what?
Your service. And speaking about service, so I don't forget, I need to deliver a package to Achyuta Gopi's father-in-law. Would anybody like to bring that? Okay, Joy? There's a white bag in there. You give that to, you give that to Achyuta Gopi,
mm-hmm.
and tell her that's for her father-in-law from Dhanadharsa.
Okay.
Okay. Your question.
Okay, it's just I'm almost a little bit afraid to ask it, but it's just something that I would like to talk about at the beginning of our talk, especially since we're going to a temple today.
That's okay.
But having been raised Catholic. I'm not a practicing Catholic. So, and when I started along the yoga path, I will say that I started to even reintroduce the idea of God.
What's that?
The idea of God into my life. But it's still, I still don't really know exactly what we're talking about. And so I feel like when, and that's something that has been talked about a lot so far here with you and God. So, can we just maybe just talk a little bit about what we're talking about when we're talking about God?
Okay, that is definitely part of today's lecture.
Okay, good.
When I get to the Narada Bhakti Sutras.
Okay.
Okay, what is the nature of the divine? But for now, you can consider it as a conscious reality that's inclusive of everything. And we'll go more beyond that. Advyam Dhyan means consciousness, which is the basis of existence, and which is nothing is outside of, which we have a relationship with. And therefore, it does not have the defect of impersonality. That absolute reality doesn't have the defect of impersonality. It can reciprocate. It's actually a classical definition of God. And it's also described in the Yoga Sutras, you know, the different qualities. That's basically what, and you may or may not believe or whatever, but I'm just saying my duty is to present what the bhakti tradition is. And I'm going to explain, I have it in the plan, what Krishna is in relationship to God. It's a very interesting concept of what God is. And I think as we discuss, and I like this kind of exchange, and I really appreciate it. That's one thing I thought yesterday, was hearing Sri Vrindavan talk. I said, you know, when he says the Lord, you know, maybe use absolute reality, divine, you know, maybe just like, wow. You know, who knows what people. But one thing I found out in America that I really appreciate, because when I first started to lecture, you know, because most of my life I was a teacher of the tradition to people within the tradition. And about 15, 20 years ago, I started to go and lecture to people. And I didn't know really, you know. And I was too held back. But I found out, you know, somehow or other, you know, Americans generally believe in God. It's just, you know, America, you go to France, you know, I have this one, he's a Sanskrit scholar, and he's a good friend of mine. You know, and he came to France, and then he came to America. It's a different world. Americans somehow believe in God. So therefore, I'm a little, you know, I really, you know, religiously, in terms of my talking, really try to work through people's frame of reference. You know what I'm saying? So I thought yesterday, that's why I was going back, and I started with God, because I said, wait a second, they're talking so directly. What do people think of God? What is their conceptions of God? Do they accept God, etc., like that? So I definitely want to discuss that. And again, we're filtering it through our frame of reference. You have experience as a Catholic, you know what I'm saying? So you hear that term, you know what I'm saying? Then the guilt comes, and the, you know, 10 generations, mighty.
My mother.
Yeah, so that's what I'm saying. That's why I started today with that point. Because in the way I'm thinking, and if you want to be a good teacher and endear people to you, what you do is you find the people's frame of reference, and through that expand their knowledge, expand their perception, and therefore expand their happiness. Because it's understood in any tradition of self-improvement, spirituality, if you increase people's knowledge, their frame of reference, their perception, you're going to increase their well-being. Everyone tries to give people knowledge, right? It'll make them happier. But you won't be able to do that unless you start with people's frame of reference. And therefore, unless the subject that you are teaching, you practice and realize. Because otherwise, once you even understand their frame of reference, you may not have the ability to take that knowledge and form it according to their understanding. Okay, but we're going to get to that in the Narada Bhakti Sutras for sure. It's actually the third verse. They discuss this, and we have to discuss it. And I have a whole lecture prepared on that within this class today, which means, you know, something. I should just explain two more points about bhakti, the difference between humility and a lack of self-esteem. Humility, here, this is God, this is reality, you're part of reality, right? When you have material consciousness, you falsely think you're the center, and you see things as object of your enjoyment. When you're spiritual, your life is God-centered and you see yourself as the object. You're the servant. Your mood is to please. Everything. So it's a very humble position. We're talking spiritual life means humility. People always, what's the difference between low self-esteem and humility? Humility means that you, you're happy to be insignificant, small. You're happy because your size has nothing to do with your capacity to love. In fact, it may increase it. And love is the goal. In fact, if you get into the deeper aspect of the philosophy of my tradition, the position of the devotee is greater than God, because the lover enjoys more than the beloved. The child is the object of the mother's love. The mother is the lover, the child is the beloved. The child is enjoying motherly love. The mother is enjoying motherly love. Same energy from different sides. The mother's pleasure is greater. So we don't mind. You're happy about it. You feel small, you're happy about it. You don't want to be great. You want to serve. And lack of self-esteem means you feel yourself insignificant and you're unhappy about it because you want to be great. So it causes a psychological aberration. And it's not based on any spiritual quality. It's based on an egotistical desire that's not being fulfilled. So humility is, you don't want to be great, you're happy. Low self-esteem is, you want to be great, you're not happy. And then I wanted to mention something about codependence, which is also not humility. Codependence means that you're becoming attached to fulfill someone else's desire for yourself, not to please them. And therefore, you fulfill desires of that person that are neither good for him or good for the universe. So really, humility means you don't just whimsically follow any authority, any desires. You follow the desires of God, you follow the desires of those who are pure, and you satisfy the needs of others. Not that you whimsically surrender to any whim that anybody has, and you think that's service. You look at people's needs, and if someone is pure, you follow their desire. Because their desire will be the universal desire, not any selfish desire that will entangle them. We followed so far. I just wanted to help with the frame of reference here. Yes?
So, would you say that bhakti, like I'm just having trouble intellectualizing
it,
serving if it doesn't take away from myself, or serving if it takes away from myself, even if it takes away from
serving is yourself. And the conception is that the ultimate reality, what ultimately is there, is this exchange of love and devotion. So bhakti is not just a conception, it's a feeling. It's the feeling of the soul reflected in the consciousness of universal love. That's what bhakti is. And a person who has that conception in his mind, has that feeling pervaded, he just wants to serve. Yes?
Could you possibly talk a little bit about service? Well, I'm just trying to be in like a regular situation where you would want to be helpful and give to somebody in need.
Right.
What about in a situation where the person in need is hungry for the things that you're giving? and so they want more and more and more. Does that make sense? Like, if people can be taken advantage of, like, so how do you protect yourself from being taken advantage of if you're just constantly giving?
Because, we all have a capacity, and we all have a capacity, and it's just like myself. I try to serve, but I go to India and I spend a month. It's the next month coming up, just in meditation for a month. You can't give unless you get something. So you obviously have to protect yourself, and also you don't want to lose it. You want to help someone. Right, so ultimately, if you're really looking at someone, you're looking at it as spiritual, and naturally you feel compassion, but their real pain is not anything that's transforming in the body. The real pain is the ignorance that they identify with it. The body is changing, it's inevitable. Right? In the Bhagavad Gita, it says the body's changing. Think of the verse. You know, the pain or spin, yatabe, hey, komaram, yoganam, jarata, tabe, hankara, papiya. As the embodied soul passes from boyhood to childhood to youth to old age, similarly at the time of death, they go to another destination. Someone who's sober, he's not bewildered by such a change. So the real compassion that one has is not that one is changing bodies. That's inevitable. But the compassion they have is that because of ignorance, they're identifying with it and suffering. Death is the illusion of non-existence. We're eternal. But when we're an illusion, we think we're the body, then we experience or fear non-existence. But that's an illusion because we're eternal. So really, a spiritual person is really, he's concerned for a person's suffering, but he's more concerned for their ultimate suffering, which is spiritual, which is a lack of knowledge, a lack of understanding. Look at yourselves now and think of different people in your family. Now, what I'm going to assume is that in your family, you're quite enlightened. It's generally like that. You're the ones in New York that are paying to get knowledge, etc. Generally, it's like, someone may say, oh, my family is so... But I have a younger brother and I have an older brother. You know, and I see the difference between me and them, and the question and happiness is that I am in a spiritual tradition and I have knowledge. Even my father, they weren't very happy when I first came into this. But I told you the story, I was actually kidnapped, attempted deprogrammed, it was a whole thing, yeah. But after that, my parents came to India in 1982. And like that, and my father turned to me, and he's from New York, and he looked at me and he said, I have three sons, and you're the only one with his head screwed on right. So, people appreciate knowledge. So, in answer to your question, you know, you're not just going to, you know, filling needs more and more and more and more and more. That's just increasing their passion. If you actually understand the philosophy, what's passion? More, 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 more. So, you know, just serving the person in that way and increasing their needs, increasing their desires, you're degrading their mind. So what's the question of helping them? You know, the question of helping them is, if you really have a perspective of knowledge, you say no, like a parent. Two things a parent will do to make a good child. They'll give affection and they'll set boundaries. If there's not sufficient affection, the child would be susceptible to depression because there's not imprints of hope within the consciousness where they can face the adversities of them. If boundaries are not set, the child will be susceptible to anxiety attacks because the world is changing every day. That's why it's good to be born in a tradition with appropriate values and, you know, and good parental figures that, you know, say, this is the world. You don't negotiate. The world is 20 ice creams one day when I'm feeling generous to my son, and nothing today. Or you negotiate how much you cry, you get. So really, if I think Sri Vrindavan's point is correct, if you're focused spiritually on the elevation of the soul, you'll make choices for yourself and for others for their benefit, according to Dharma. And if you went to a spiritual advisor, they say, it's not your duty to spoil people. It's not your duty to become codependent. They would give you that advice. And that's the universal desire. That's the desire that's good for everyone. That's the desire that's good for you. Okay? I am going to keep a little... I have the curriculum to follow. But I'm also very, very open to this, because I really do feel that these kind of discussions are essential to understand the subject matter. Now, I want to go over something again yesterday and explain deity worship with our concept. Again, what deity worship is, and tantra. Tantra means dealing with matter to attain spirit. And we are surrounded by things. So what deity worship and these types of functions are, on one level, is rearranging matter in a mode of service. I'll give you an example. If you go to Sri Vrindavan, let me explain the deity one more time. Because a lot, bhakti, look on the wall there. You're going to see those deities today. We're going to go to the temple to see those deities. I want to explain basically what the deity is. He explained it. It's something like this. It's authorized. What does that mean? It means just like a mailbox. You can make a box that's red, white, and blue. But if you're not authorized by the governor, it won't have mystic potency. If it's authorized by the government, you put a letter in there, you put a little code, and it goes to a village in Zaire. You know, it goes to a little village in, any place. So it's that authorization. So in the Indian culture, there's a pran pratishtha, a ceremony that transform this energy as a receptacle for the divine and your feelings towards the divine. It's not idol. And it's just like energy can be transformed. Electricity can make a cold in a refrigerator. Electricity can make hot on an electric stove. So it's all God's energy. And what makes energy material? What makes energy spiritual? Basically, it's your conception of it. If you look at it, I am the controller. This is for me. Then it's material. If you look at it, this is for God, this is for others, it's spiritual. So what happens is when you have a deity in the house, and someone like Sri Vrindavan, I can't say enough, really his personal life, and the level of sadhana, and especially this type of worship and his realizations, that... In his house, therefore, everything belongs to God. It's a whole different conception. Like you go in the kitchen, what do? When I grew up in New York, a mother was not a good mother unless she kept a cookie box with Hostess Twinkies and Chips Ahoy, and you just eat all day. I mean, I don't know how we did it in those days. You ate dinner, you opened up the refrigerator an hour later. Right? So, but now, in a spiritual house, that's for God. It's for service, and the cooking is offered with devotion to God. It completely changes the consciousness. I was fortunate to be in the presence of my Guru Maharaj in his room, and it was very intense. Why? Because he was a bhakta. He was a devotee. Everything was for service. So it had a spiritual feeling to everything. Rather than you just set yourself up and everything is according to you and your whims. endlessly. Again, we enjoy to live, we don't live to enjoy, we have needs. Then that also becomes spiritual. My teacher also had some physical needs, those things were there. But it was all connected to this idea that we are made for something greater than ourselves. And again, ritual is to conform your world to something greater than yourself. And it happens also in your actions. I just gave the example. If you go like this, it's such a nice mudra. My hand, for those who are sitting on the thing, my hands are together. It's a mudra. And what does it mean? These hands are for you. I've changed them from the selfish person to the selfless person. You know what dandavats is? Danda means stick. Vat means like a stick. You fall down like a stick. You see sometimes a saintly person, you fall down like a stick. You see the deities, you fall down like a stick. What happens is the mind follows the body. You're putting yourself in a consciousness. People go around the sacred hill where I live. It takes 5 hours to walk. They go down by dandavats. They just go, and they get up, and their feet go in, and they walk around. And people who've done it tell them it's just amazing. You're giving totally. And another thing you do spiritually is you go to the temple, you walk around it. And again, what is it doing? It's putting you on the periphery. It's putting you in the humble mood. And that is pleasure. Because you can never experience kindness unless you're humble. Like a spoiled child, the parents take that whining brat. They take him, I want this, I want this, I want this. And the parents give them everything. And the child is still not happy. Right? He didn't experience love. Why? Because he's not humble. And if someone is humble, then a pat on the head, they feel love in their heart. So a bhakta does not even like to be praised. Because he's experiencing so much love and joy in his heart from folding his hands and putting his head down. Like that sadhu I told you, who is James Bay's guru. And they, oh, everyone must come to eat. He's walking. He's humble. But the Vaishnavas come It's happiness. It's feeling good. Because you're part of something greater. It's insignificance, but it's worth, it's value. And you're feeling that in your heart, your being. And that's a happy person. I'll tell you one story here. The last class says, Vrindavan, because I'm inviting you all to come, like I did today. So I take people. Because you come initially, you may see it's getting built up over the city, but I take people 10 minutes, I take them out to the fields. So, this blind girl, I met her in Croatia, this Kirtan retreat. Beautiful girl from the heart. Not just physical, but sometimes physical is a product, physical beauty is a product of I want to enjoy, of being a lust. And sometimes physical beauty is a product of, like, love. You just want to please everybody. A very beautiful girl, blind. She came, she couldn't see any, you know, she came and she got a place on the main road while she was hearing this truck. So, oh my God. Then she came to us, like, look at the forest. She was feeling the breezes. The birds, she was hearing the birds. She was smelling the fragrance. She was seeing for nothing. We were walking on the path, and that year there were floods, and we met one farmer. And when we met that farmer, he started talking the local language, and it was Vrijabas, and he was saying, And someone's translating. It's most people even speak Hindi there, but Roger Bas, and he was translating, and the flood wiped out his farm. He lost 2 lakhs, which is $4,000. None of you would like that, but in India, for a farmer, that's more like $200,000. You know, he lost a lot. And they have this dowry system, which has been perverted. Now, initially, what would happen is, the tradition is when the girl would get married, she'd go to her husband's house. That's not so bad. But what would happen is, the father would give the dowry at that time. He would give the inheritance at that time. So it was a very nice thing. He gave the inheritance at that time. The father, well, you're going to another house. Here, I have 2 children. Here's half my wealth. You take it to them. But then it's corrupted now, so people try to get more money. You can't get them married in the system. They are, okay, here's the check. It's in the refrigerator, in the car. And the parents are doing it. He has 4 daughters. He has to get married. But his heart was sparkling. His eyes, every part of him was just brilliant and sparkling. Diamonds and... I asked him, why is he so happy? Why is he so happy? And he said, a mantra, a simple person. Devotion. Happiness is a heart filled with devotion. Happiness is a heart filled with love. And that has to do with your humility, your ability to feel grace, your ability to feel mercy. Okay, so I wanted to kind of get us all on the same page. I'm pretty happy now that we have a basic conception. Now, we just went for an hour. Do you need a 5-minute break? What?
Yes.
Okay. 5-minute break. I want this to, because then we're going to start the Narada Bhakti Sutras. And I've taken more time than I want at the beginning. But maybe we won't get through the whole thing. But I did, and I'll show you how to study it. Okay, let's all take a break, okay? But really, have a quarter or two, I start speaking, okay? Okay, if anybody wants to ask questions, those are the 3 to 5. I'm feeling I have to move forward and cover ground, but it's not as important as really getting the essence in. I really feel good. Like I said, I got a lot of good input yesterday from people thanking me. They liked the class, but I wasn't satisfied. I felt that, you know, the frame of reference wasn't yet established, you know?
We know that feeling.
What?
As yoga teachers, we know that feeling.
Yeah. And therefore I discussed these points, and one of them was about, you know, the concept of God. And how that is filtered through people's frame of reference. Do you have that sheet that I gave on the first verse of the Narada Bhakti Sutras? No, there was some lecture. There was, I'm writing now, I want to make a contemporary Bhakti book based on this. So I wrote the first commentary on it. You should have gotten it. That's one of them. That.
Can I just see the second one?
I'm going to just read something. In the Narada Bhakti Sutra, it's not even one of the most traditionally studied books in bhakti. The other ones are the Bhagavad, is specifically the main book, the Bhagavad Gita. It's 12 cantos, it's like 12 books. It's very, very comprehensive. I studied that deeply. When we came to this class, and I'm trying to figure out what is a curriculum, you know, to give it. So I thought of this because I saw it was the Yoga Sutras. And it was translated. In our tradition, by my teacher, Narada Bhakti Sutras, and there were several other editions of it. Narada is probably in the Bhakti tradition one of the most famous saints. He's the guru of Vyas, who is attested to have written the Yoga Sutras, for example. Vyas is Vyasadeva. Vyas in Sanskrit means editor. Deva means the godly editor. And it means that the Vedas, as it has an image that as God breathes out, we'll discuss God later, but get the analogy. God breathes out, the world comes out, and with the world comes the knowledge on how to use it for self-realization. Which includes how to satisfy your needs, how to socialize society, medical things, everything, an integrated philosophy. Everything has a use, a utility, a purpose, a knowledge, and Vedas is considered knowledge. But it has to be occasionally edited to the frame of reference of the particular people. The person who does that is called Vyas. Because he has deep realization, he can take those vast Vedas. Basically, there was one Veda, but then when people couldn't understand it, he divided it into four, right? And then he told it in story form, that's the Mahabharata. Then he codified it, that's called the Vedanta Sutra. And then he wrote a commentary for the Vedanta Sutra, that's called the Bhagavatam. And there's a whole story of that. And it actually has a lot to do with Narada. So Narada is a famous personality. There's a whole story of him. You know, it's. I realized, what was I going to say for 15 hours, but now I'm thinking it's like it's not enough time for me. You know, Narada, the whole story of Narada is amazing. He was born as the son of a maidservant. And he didn't even know who his father was. Now that's unheard of in Indian culture. Sometimes you find one or two people in modern age, very rare, you know who your father is. So his mother was a maidservant in the ashram of Bhakti Vedanta, scholarly devotees. And he was just very, very humble. And he attracted their mercy. And they enlightened him. And then, right after that, his mother died from a snake bite. And he was only 5 years old. And he just left to find God. Experience all of God's creation. And then he had deep, deep realizations. And then, it's a long story. And he got Sakshat Darshan. God appeared to him. The divine appeared to him. But then told him that you got some mercy, but you had two problems that you no, then he did God, the divine disappeared, Narayan, and then he went into meditation again with the same effort, but he couldn't achieve the goal. Because bhakti, effort's not enough. You need mercy. And mercy requires an attitude. So you can work and not get it if you start developing an egotistical attitude. So it wasn't like gross egotistical attitude, but somehow or other he got some grace and he tried by his effort. But bhakti cannot be caused. It has to descend. You can nurture your heart and make yourself a receptacle of mercy by your humility and cleaning your heart. And therefore, so he only heard a voice the next time that says, you had not completely, he said, you had two things. You had a material taint. And what was that? He was attached to his goodness. He was attached to the Himalayas. He was attached to the peace. But attached to his passion. It's not pure. Still, it was attached. He was attached to goodness. But it was still for him. So he wasn't yet. And he said, you're not complete in service. Which means the attitude of humility and service. So then Narada, he's a musician. He's the first, really, the Adi Kirtanir. He went with his Veena and traveled all over the universe singing on the Veena, Kirtan. And that's the story of Narada, helping and appearing with any person as legitimate. So this is credited to Narada, whether or not it is the Narada, just like the Vyas of the Yoga Sutras. They don't know if someone just gave them the name Vyas because they were an editor, you know. But it's accepted as a traditional text. It's philosophically sound, and great teachers have commented on it. So now I'm going to cover some of the sutras. Wow. Okay. So what this is, I did this for the class. What I did is I took the sutras and made them into sentences in English. They're sutras, but I kind of made it more like a cohesive story here. I guess it's my own translation here. So it says, therefore, now we describe bhakti. Now, let me read first what a sutra is, an aphorism. It's from my commentary in the first verse. It says, a sutra is a short statement that codifies a larger body of thinking. Most schools of Indian thought express themselves in this way to help their adherents assimilate their teachings. As volumes of meaning are condensed within very terse aphorisms, they are accompanied by commentaries where learned practitioners help to unpack them. In this way, a student can memorize many of the sutras while studying the commentaries, thus holding an entire philosophical system within their mind. So this is sutra, it's the Vedanta Sutra. For example, the first Vedanta Sutra is Atato Brahma Jigyasa. So much meaning. What does Atato mean? Atato means urgency. Why urgency? Why now urgency? Because you've come to a human form of life. There's 8,400,000 species of life. It's funny. In the Vedas, it says there's 8,400,000 species of life. I read in a magazine report by scientists, they have now concluded from studying that there's 8,700,000 species of life. So they consider that the Vedas is authoritative knowledge. And if you experiment, you'll come to the same conclusions. So I thought scientists have come, and they're wrong. It's 8,400,000. But they're coming close. But it means this. It means that you have a human form of life, and it's very rare. Because you have the ability to... It's Atato Brahma Jigyasa, because you can inquire. You have free will. You can inquire into the nature of reality. You have free will to change, to understand the divine. Animals do not have free will. So therefore they can't improve themselves. They can't realize the absolute. So we have this ability, and if you don't use it, you're considered a kripana. It means a miser. What is a miser? A miser is a person whose wealth doesn't use it. You have this wealth. And that means this is what your life is meant for. Atato Brahma Jigyasa, to inquire into Brahman, to inquire into God, to inquire into reality, to inquire into the self. That's the purpose of life. This is the Vedanta system. I'm showing you. So someone can impact. So you have a few words. So what we'll try to do is, you'll have the philosophy of bhakti here, and we'll try to impact some of the verses, and you'll have kind of notes on it, and you can refer to them. So the first says, now we describe bhakti. So the word is atta. I think the verses are also given at the end, but let's see. It says, atato bhaktim yakyasyama. Now we will describe bhakti. So this word atta, let's expand it, has so much meaning. What does it mean? It means there's an urgency. There's urgency. And what generally a particular school does, they're promoting their school. So this is the way, bhakti. It's significant. It's not only significant, you may say, now you're coming to bhakti, now you're coming to devotion, you can realize yourself. And that's the purpose of human life. Now, why bhakti is promoted, I'm just going to try to explain. What does yoga mean? It means to focus on one thing. Watch the hands here. This is the mind. These are the vrittis. And what's happening when the vrittis come? It's distorting the mind. The mind is a lens. And what's the purpose of a lens? To see things clearly. If you see things clearly, you'll see yourself. You'll understand yourself. You'll see yourself. You'll see that you're eternal. You have no more problems once you can see yourself. Your problems is your perception and not your actuality. And why don't you have proper perception? Because the mind is distorted. And because the mind is distorted, your perception is distorted. And that's done by that static of selfish desires that come into the mind. Two things can prevent a lens from functioning. Dirt and distortion. Dirt is all your selfish desires, and distortion is the thoughts that manifest from them. So how does yoga work? You pick one thing to meditate on. It can be arbitrary. And at least you'll stop. It's a strategy. Okay, just keep one thing and the other things will kind of pacify. And when we do this in yoga, we do this. When we meditate like that, your mind becomes peaceful. Why? You're at a higher level of perception and reality. Because your mind has been moved to a higher level of goodness. Now, why is bhakti, according to Gita, considered the topmost yoga? In the Gita it says, yogi nam api sarvesham madgatena taratam shanhavam. Of all yogis, one who worships me with faith and devotion is the highest of all. Why? Because in bhakti, the object of your devotion is, let's not use God now because people, is Brahman. Okay? It's Brahman. It's the absolute reality. Okay? Usually, according to yoga sutras, manifest in mantras. Right? Shabda Brahman. Brahman coming in mantras. So you're focused on a mantra. Now what's the advantage? The advantage is in bhakti, you're choosing an object of meditation which you have an inherent, natural, loving relationship with. So therefore, the focus on your object of meditation is spontaneous and natural. Where traditionally, if you pick an object that's arbitrary, your meditation is, I should do this. It's from the platform of the buddhi, the intelligence. In bhakti is, I want to do this. Because you have sambandhi, you have a relationship with that object. And people who do kirtan understand the effect of mantra meditation. Because even though they're not yogis, when Satchinananda Swami was here the other day, fantastic. For 3 hours, it was like a minute. And we were absorbed. Because of the mantra. And his ability to get us to focus on the mantra and develop our heart's relationship with the mantra. That's the advantage of bhakti. According to the bhakti tradition, which believes that the divine can manifest in sound. So you have a relationship with that object. The second advantage of bhakti is because it's not just a meditational prop, but it is absolute reality with power. It can reciprocate with your meditation. Because that's what lover devotion is. Lover devotion is a relationship. So when love means a relationship, reciprocation. So you're loving, and then there's a reciprocation. By the power that's controlling the matter that's binding you and covering you. Even in the Yoga Sutras, I don't know if I have the verses here, but I can bring them tomorrow. No, I didn't bring it today, but Yoga Sutras, all the commentaries describe grace. They all describe grace. If you really want to study all the commentaries, when they discuss Ishvara Pranidhan, they discuss grace. That there's a reciprocation of pleasure in that universal spirit, Brahman. Recognizing your desire and giving you some grace to achieve it. And therefore, it's considered the path of bhakti, which is the path of grace, that you can achieve much more than your effort. And that's the difference between bhakti marg and jnana marg. Jnana marg means by your own effort. If you read the Yoga Sutras, it seems impossible. The subtleties of meditation. First you meditate on the object. Then you meditate on the object without conception. Then you meditate on prakriti, or matter, the basis of the object. And then after that, then you're beginning your meditation. And the other thing is, all spiritual paths are to root out ego. In bhakti, you're getting at the root of egocentricism, which is by humility, and devotion, and surrender, and sacrifice. So for that reason, in the Yoga Sutra, you're saying now it's giving the urgency and it's promoting this path. And those are the reasons why they're doing it. Okay, any questions on that? We're one or two verses from God. Okay, now the second verse says, its nature is transcendental divine love. So this is the definition of bhakti, and what it says is sattvasmin parama prema rupa. Rupa means it has its form as parama prema. Hey, this dude. It says it has its form as, I was just mentioning to you this just before, not in the class, but to some people from Texas, that two of the girls studying from Texas, and they were surprised that they were such big, that I lived in Texas at one of the ashrams. And then I explained that your guru, you know, went to Texas and established these ashrams. This is Kasuba, who will also be one of their teachers. So the second verse is Sattvasmin Parama Prema Rupa. It has the form of prema, that means selfless, intense love. plus men for the Supreme Lord. So our question was about God, and what I'm saying is, we're going to discuss God. What I'm saying is, whether you believe it or not, we're studying the Bhakti tradition. In the Bhakti tradition, Bhakti is the form of supreme love for God. That's what it is. And we'll discuss a little bit about the nature of God. What is Parama Prema? Parama Prema, as we've been discussing, is sincerity. It's the desire to please God. And we've discussed this, how it's universal. The desire to please God. That's sincere. There's no other intention. That's what love means. One was a true bhakta. That's his only desire. Not his desire. What does my Lord, what is my beloved, what do they want? And I become an object for their pleasure. And in that mood, then the spirit of divine love comes from your heart. And again, what was our initial paradigm? Look up. Material consciousness is what? Everything is your desire. You see the world according to your desire. Then everything kind of becomes objects for you. And in Sanskrit, that's called maya or illusion. Because that's not what they are. They're not yours. They belong to something greater and are meant to be used for something greater. So this is what illusion means. Right? And what happens is when the pure soul, and that was another question that was brought up that I wanted to address. How did we get there? So it somehow or other has a concept that this is what we are. We're a particle of consciousness. We're receptacles of love. And the energy of love is supposed to flow through our hearts to the divine. And that's what's flowing. That's what ultimate reality is. When you become free from illusion. And what happens is, this is actually another way to look at bhakti. It's three categories of philosophical understanding. One is called sambandhagyan, basically metaphysical. Well, what is reality? Reality is divine and divine energies. And energy means what? Energy means to please its source. You have a sensual energy, it's to give you pleasure. You have a knowledge energy, it's to give you pleasure. You have a strength energy, it's to give you pleasure. So there's the divine and energy. You can't separate them any more than you can separate a rose in its scent, a fire in its light. So it's part of that absolute reality, is this energy. What does energy mean? Energy means there's love, because energy is to please its source. Energy needs to please its source. So the essence of all Shakti is Ladini, pleasure. And the essence of all pleasure is love. So the essence of all Shakti is love. Energies are coming from that absolute reality. And they're flowing back to the absolute reality to please the absolute reality. And if we awaken ourselves, we're part of that. And that energy flows through our hearts. And we experience love and pleasure. And that's what bhakti is. So what happens is, this is who we are, remember? We're not the subject and everything's object. We're the object. But somehow or other, what happens is, we're, with that free will, we're averse to what we are, which is part of the divine. And when we're averse to what we are, and we ignore what we are, and we want to be something else, we want to be this, then we get covered with the mind and body, which creates this illusion that we're the enjoyer and we're the controllers. And then what is bhakti again? Create conditions that take this liquidity that has become ice, create some conditions that melt it again. And that's called bhakti. It means acting on that platform of trying to please the divine. And there's a verse that's given by one of the great teachers, Anyabhilashita Shunya Dhyana Karma Dhyanabhritam Anukulyena Krishnanu Shilanam Bhakti. What is bhakti? Bhakti is shilanam, its activities of mind, body, and soul. Krishna Anushilanam, Uttama Bhakti, real bhakti, real devotion. Krishna Anushilanam, it's mind, body, and words. Anu Shilanam, that Anukulyena, our favor, we have the intention to please God, we have the intention to please divine. You have the intention to be what you are. A energy, a particle of consciousness that is meant to please the whole. And anyabhilashita shunyam, without any other desires. And not covered by selfishness or wanting to be anything else. So the practice of that is called bhakti. And it's described how you do it, and how you live, and how you focus your consciousness. And again, every object has a potency. So when you focus on the divine, it has a bhakti shakti, and you will feel it. Why? Because there's relationship. And the attraction between two entities with relationship is called love. So that's what kirtan is. You focus on the object of your love. In the sound, in the deity, in the devotees. And when that happens, it draws out your natural spontaneous feelings. So there's two ways. You focus on kirtan, you focus on that, it draws out the nature of the soul. And then the second way is by acts of devotion. They also have that potency. And there's many practices. Shravanam, you hear about the divine. Kirtanam, you chant the divine. Smaranam, meditation on the divine. Shravanam, kirtanam, vishnu, padaseva, you do humble service. I think you're going to be doing that today with Ananda. Humble service. In that mood. And we discussed it in a very broad way, how it means to others and what the connection is. Padasevanam, vandanam, you offer prayers. Archanam, you do puja. Again, boy, you put something else in the center besides yourself and everything becomes an object for that and you live in that place. That's deity worship. And it's a life of love. And that's Vrindavan. It's when he's in his house, everything is focused not on him. So, this is bhakti. It's parama prema rupa. It has the form of the topmost love. And the practice is to achieve that. Because one thing about love that's very interesting, that's different from karma and jnana, listen carefully. The means and the end are not different in bhakti. In karma, you do work to get some material reward. The pleasure is the reward, not the sacrifice. Vayam natu vichityama uttama shoka vartate yachringatam rasayanam svadu svadu pade pade. Vayam natu vichityama uttama shoka vartate. We never become tired. Uttama shloka varte, by chanting the uttama shloka, the verses about the highest thing, the divine. Yachrinvatam rasa jnanam. And when we hear that rasa jnana, that understanding of rasa, of divine love, swadu, swadu, pade, pade, we relish at every step. Why do they say that? They're doing sacrifice. Swaha, they put the swaha means I give myself in the fire. They do it for 1,000 years, they get tired and smoke.
But they said, they never get tired of that. The Trinity Rasa Swadhu Swadhu Padepade. So this is bhakti. It's defined in that way, this selfless devotion. Now we're going to start getting to the issue of God. Brahman. Actually, technically speaking, in Latin, God doesn't really refer to the highest aspect of the absolute reality. The creator is not the highest aspect of the absolute reality. The highest aspect of the absolute reality is the heart of love of the absolute reality, not the control of the absolute reality. Okay, now the third verse, and we're going to go into that question here. It says, this, its nature is eternal. Okay? What nature? That love's nature is eternal. It means it's part of reality. It's not just a means to achieve it. Let me go back one thing, I forgot the point. So in bhakti, or love, there's no objective or goal. The practice is bhakti. What's the goal? The goal is bhakti. It's just having better bhakti or more pure devotion. But in jnana, when you perform austerities, is that the goal? To eternally sit in the lotus pose? There's some other goal, which is moksha or liberation. That's the pleasure, not what you're doing. But bhakti is the goal and bhakti is the means. Bhakti is, in this tradition, ultimate reality is an aesthetic experience. An overwhelming emotion of joy, love, sacrifice, and devotion. That's what it is according to tradition. It's not just a means that you do bhakti to get something else. So it says bhakti is eternal, and bhakti requires three things, which is actually mentioned in the previous verse. What are the three things that bhakti or devotion requires? It requires an object of devotion, the divine. It requires a subject of devotion, the soul, and it requires the devotion itself. So what it's saying here in this verse, that's eternal. It's not that we practice bhakti and the result of bhakti is the annihilation of our individuality and that we lose our distinction. Yes, we become one. Just like, again, the hand is the body, but has a function within the body. So if the absolute reality is filled with love, within that one harmonious whole, there must be a type of distinction for the purpose of love. Now, people in America sometimes get confused about this because there's a school of Indian philosophy called Advaita Vedanta. And that school presents that in liberation there's no distinction. You have no individuality. It merges into an amorphous one. It's a popular view because that view came over to America first, but it's not the predominant view in India. There are six darshans. One of the darshans means philosophies. There's yoga, which is basically psychology. There's nyaya, which is there's logic. There's asheshika, which is basically scientific inquiry. And then there's sankhya, which is philosophical analysis, and then there's Vedanta. In Vedanta, one school is called Advaita Vedanta. And they proposed this view. And this is what they explain. And I'm just going to explain what their philosophy is. And this is going to get into God and why there should be God. I'm saying, when it says here that it's eternal, it's saying that you don't merge, according to bhakti. That you are eternal. Bhakti is eternal. The soul is eternal. And this is the predominant view in the Yoga Sutras. The soul achieves a certain type of self-awareness. And there's a Vishesha Purush, there's another soul. This view is absolute distinction. You can't even name anything. You can't even say it's Brahman, because then there's duality. This view is minority view. Bhagavad Gita says, Nitvevaham jatunasam natvam neme janadipa asagana pavishasa. Never was there a time where I did not exist, nor you, nor all the kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. Eternal individuality of the soul. That is God, or the divine has inconceivable potency, and by that inconceivable potency, this is the ultimate reality. We're particles of consciousness. We're meant to be receptacles of love. Now basically, I explain this, some bhakti, there's a metaphysics. Okay, that reality according to bhakti is God and God's energy. Then there's abhideya. Well, how do you realize that? So in the bhakti philosophy, you realize the absolute reality by turning towards the absolute reality, by embracing the absolute reality, by focusing on the absolute reality. Why? Because why are we an illusion and we don't see the God? We see everything separate and individual from the divine. We see that ultimate duality. Why? Because we're averse to who we are. And because we're averse to who we are, we're covered to think we're something else, which is an enjoyer and controller, rather than a beautiful particle of consciousness that's meant for love. We're covered. So if the cause is aversion to what we are, we're averse to God, we're averse to something greater than ourselves, and therefore we're averse to who we are as a part of God. So if the cause is aversion, then the means of realizing that absolute is love. If aversion has caused the illusion, like you want to get rid of the disease, find out what caused it and reverse it. So if the disease is hate that covers us from reality, then the means of realizing reality is to embrace reality. Yes?
Why are we reversed? Is it
that?
That's why.
We explained that point, that love requires volition. So if I sometimes say, if you want to make a perfect world, I'll make everyone love.
Right.
But then you made everybody dead stones. Because you took away their volition. Anyway, this question is very deep. It's not so simple. And it probably would be a whole seminar. Generally, in philosophical traditions in India, almost all of them don't like to discuss origins. Because it's inconceivable. They consider something like you're in a well and you're drowning. The rope comes. And, oh, where did it come from? How did I get here? And pull up. That's what their view is. Generally, it's the main view. Now, so now I want to explain what their philosophy is. And this is it, Brahman, or that divine, they accept it, that it's something which unites, pervades, supports. It's mentioned in the Upanishads, the philosophical thing. And then they have these images of gods. So, and they have these images of distinction. There are people, there are relationships, all these things are presented. So their argument is, well, there are statements in the Upanishads, Tattvamasi, you are that, and things. And they have other things. Well, if something is distinct from God, then God must be less. He must be fragile. How can God be changed? So if we have individual distinction, then the absolute reality must have been changed. Then it can't be Brahman. So they have all these type of arguments. and their resolution is, then everything must be illusion. That basically, that's their point. That everything must be illusion. So, the arguments against that are, you have problems with that. Because then how do you account, what's the support of illusion? If everything's illusion here, what is the support of illusion? So you say, oh, the living entities are support of illusion. But they're also illusion, according to that. So they can't be the support of illusion. So then Brahman has to be the support of illusion. But then if Brahman is an illusion, then how can he be Brahman? And if he is an illusion, there's also distinction. So from a philosophical view, you can't hold up that philosophy, and it's not our practical experience. And you're also denying the reality of love, which is also a distinction. And, like I said, the Gita, the Danta. So their conclusion is that there's an absolute reality that has energies and inconceivable potency. In fact, in the Isha Upanishads, it says, Om Pranam, 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 Pranam. The absolute reality is perfect and complete, and because he's perfect and complete, there's so many units that emanate from him, and he remains complete. He has inconceivable potency, like our fingernail. Wow, it keeps on growing. The sun, the energy coming from the sun. There's so many inconceivable, so it has inconceivable potency. And the better alternative is there's one absolute harmonious reality that has distinction for the purpose of life. When I was in university, I gave a lecture at Professor Bryan's class to 300 students on this subject. I mean, I'm not going into it in depth because it's a whole seminar and lecture. But the basic point is that it's not the common view. The common view is that this individuality of the soul is distinction, and we remain individual. And that one harmonious, absolute reality has distinction for the purpose of love. And everything is within the body of the divine. But when I was in school, in Professor Bryan's class, I tried to be back to school in 40 years. So I looked at the students, I tried to bond them to them. Oh, I said, I remember when I was in school, and I was studying aeronautics. I said, I was taking up space. What, I made a joke? But if you were in the 60s, you would realize what that meant. So what happened is I got what's called the Krishna book, written by my teacher, which describes a reality of perfect love, Krishna's pastimes. We're going to discuss that a little bit. But then I was actually studying philosophy. And when I was studying philosophy, there was a definition of God that was given, that being of which no greater can be conceived. So then I thought, yes, this must be Krishna. And I'll explain Krishna later, but basically my point was, is what's greater, an amorphous mass with no distinction, or an absolute reality of energy that exchanges love? So according to the common definition of God, no greater being can be conceived. I could not deny in that absolute reality the foundation of love, which I experience here. So, now, you're not going to prove God or disprove God by logic. You'll create reasonable alternatives for your experience. You understand? You're not going to prove God or disprove God. By definition, you can't prove or disprove. But to me, it's a reasonable alternative to consider. Even I was, you know, the heavy rains, I was upstate New York, and all those heavy rains were there. And I was watching this powerful waterfall by my house. the amount and volume of water rushing. And in mine, it was very, very, I went to the Himalayas, seeing the vastness of the mountains. There's obviously powers in the world that are way beyond our conception. And basically, you have two conceptions. It's either, how do we understand reality? Does it make sense to you that reality began at a particular point and there was no reality before it? Does that make sense to you? Anybody here? There was nothing existing and then there's something existing. Does that make sense to anybody here? How about something is always existing? Does that make sense either?
No.
No. So it's got to be one or the other. You understand? So there's three pramanas according to the Yoga Sutras. There's agama, authority. There's pratyaksha, there's direct experience. There's anuman, there's logic. So from agama, or shabda, most of it, you know, the Bhagavad Gita, the Yoga Sutras, they all accept that there's divine absolute reality, a God, a consciousness, which everything is inclusive, which doesn't have the defect of impersonality. It can reciprocate. Otherwise, you're making something great which has no heart. We're not all going to understand this immediately, but on the last day, I'm going to do a drama about this subject. And Lisa has seen, Joy has seen that. She likes the drama.
It's awesome.
When I was young, when the world was younger, I lived in the mystical land of Vermont, which I suppose to you was younger, but really it's an ageless place. This was a city of magnificent temples, sadhus and sages, saintly widows, rich and colorful history, monkeys. At the time, no cell phones or computers, but most importantly, it is the home of Krishna, his family, his friends, and his loved ones. I was charged with saving the ancient Vaishnava libraries, libraries filled with musty books, old with forgotten tombs, that contain deep and esoteric passages of spiritual history and wisdom. Anyway, you'll get the whole story later. Okay? Now, I didn't want to go to, you know, I like actually, if I want to get diverted, it's hard to study, I like to Google debates between theists and atheists. And then I always wish I was in the platform of the theists, because they always generally pick such fools to play those parts. You know, and yeah, we can get into that, but you know, just understand that generally, they do accept God. Either they accept that it has shaktis or energies for the purpose of love, or that it's something that's indistinct. But they accept some divine reality, some divine power. And the bhakti accepts that this verse says it's eternal. The soul is eternal means its individuality is eternal, which means that there's something else happening in reality than some amorphous mass. And that feeling of love, which requires an object of devotion, continues into perfection.
This might be an oversimplification.
Yeah.
But the God that you're speaking of, and the God that I forgot his name already.
Krishna?
The man last night.
What?
Vrindavan.
Yeah.
Speaking of. Are we speaking of a being, or are we speaking?
What we're speaking of is a being that has greater and greater manifestations. For example, even yourself. Yesterday you were a stranger. Was I seeing you? Now, today I met you in the hall. You're from Texas. We kind of chatted about the class, right? You showed me more of yourself. You understand? So even you reveal more and more in relationship. So the concept of the absolute reality in bhakti, as there's relationship, as there, then more and more is revealed. And even yourself will be seen in certain ways. You know, one lady is a daughter, one lady is a friend, one lady is the same lady is a lover, and the same lady is a child. According to relationships. So there's different perspectives. The commonality is called Advayam Gyan. It's consciousness, which is inclusive of everything, which doesn't have the defect of impersonality. It can reciprocate in relationship. That's basically the definition of God. It may manifest in different ways according to your relationship with God. And in this kind of tradition, when we say religion, we do not talk about faith. We talk about the nature of the soul to love God. We don't talk about a faith. And we realize that there may be different manifestations of that absolute reality. But it's one thing. But why should it be limited? Right? And the last class, I'm going to explain what the concept of Krishna is. And again, it's going to give you a reasonable idea that, yes, this can be a possible conception of how the absolute reality should manifest according to the frame of reference I have now and my experiences in the world. Okay, what I'm going to do now is, because it's been a lot to digest, but I'm kind of confident that we're kind of all on the same page now. At least you know what the... You may believe, you may not believe, but my duty is to explain to you what the tradition is, speaking for itself. A lot of problems, it's called cultural imperialism. And it happened a lot in Kirtan. There's people in Bengal that... hundreds of years have practiced this kirtan. They know thousands of mantras on the madanga, the drums. They have such incredible style. And then some person comes in the West, you know, and he starts explaining it according to his culture, his whatever, his rock music, or, you know. So this is the tradition of what bhakti is. And this class is not about conversion or personal belief. It's about letting you be aware. You'll be hearing from other teachers, probably in other traditions, and probably in Advaita-Vedantists within your class too. It's just to give you what is bhakti according to the people who speak for it. Okay? Okay, now, because I do feel like I'm a little fruitive here, let me just go briefly over the next section. Okay. Attaining this divine love, a person becomes perfect, immortal, and satisfied. So basically what it's saying is this is who we are. We're loving beings. And if you fill your heart up with love and you realize God, you realize the divine, that's your nature. Now, perfect means original. Like, what's perfect water? Perfect is water. Is water without anything else that's added to the water. So perfect means yourself. So what it's saying here is, when you peel away everything that's external to the self, you'll be left with a devotee. You'll be left with a lover of God. That's perfection. It's like the water turns to ice. When you melt the ice, you'll get the water. When you melt the ego, the coverings of selfishness, there'll be a loving soul, a loving spirit within your heart. Again, it's Dharma. And so that's the eternal thing. That's the thing that doesn't change. That's why it says it's when you reach perfection, it's the thing that doesn't change. The other, you know, there's a story in what's called the Mahabharata. It's the history of India, and this great king and the whole story. He finally decides that there's so many signs that this body is temporary. Now he should give up his worldly duties and just renounce the world. He's getting older. The hairs are becoming gray. The knees are aching. The appetite's going down. And he realizes that he should be up. What the kings would do, they weren't like the yogis, but these great kings, what they would do when they realized, now it's the time to focus. I've done my duties. I've situated myself. I've satisfied my desires. I'm going to leave anyway soon. I should just completely concentrate on spirituality. They would walk to the north. And what would happen is the first thing they would do is they would take off their uniform. Because it's external to the self. You're not eternally a king. You can be demoted. You can be overthrown. In your next life, you can be, you know, you can be born, you know, as a anything, a farmer. You break the sword, you take off the medals, you rip off the uniform, and then you walk to the north. So you give that up, and eventually what happened, they'd be yogi, they'd amalgamate into what's called the Mahatattva, the collective material consciousness, all the elements of the body, and finally the last element is called the Ahankara, the subtle element that ties the body and the soul. And so when you get rid of all the coverings, you're left with a particle of consciousness that loves the divine. That's what it's saying. And so therefore it says it's perfect, it's immortal, and it's you're satisfied. Because you're acting in harmony with who you actually are. Devotee means now your heart is filled with devotion and love. And that's what you are. Your energy. You're meant to serve. You're meant to please. And when you're doing that, you become completely satisfied. And we even experience that this time. Then it says, achieving this fervors of desire and regret, repulsion and attraction, and no more. Why do we have so many fervors? Because our heart is not feeling full. We feel some emptiness. But what is the lack? The lack is love. It's not gigabytes. It's not sexual partners. It's not position. It's not fame. It's love. Now we're searching because of ignorance. I have a lack. Oh, this will make me happy. Let me get this political. I watch politicians. Why do they want to do it? What are they getting? Just grief. Suis. They just get more and more grief. Why do they want to do it? Unless they actually want to serve, which is not the case, mostly. So it's saying, when you have this, then all these fervors of desire and regret, repulsion, attraction are no more. Because you have your heart filled. You don't need anything else. You got love, you got devotion fully, selflessness, humility. You're like this, and it's flowing from your heart. That's why someone praises you, you shut your ears. You're happy. Why are they trying to give you ego again? Look at my hands. Love flows from this position, not this position. It doesn't flow from ego. It flows from service and humility. So if you achieve that position and you're feeling humble, that love is flowing through your heart. That's the position where the divine energy of love flows. Why should you go here? So someone says to you, you are great, you are wonderful, you are this, you are that. And you say, can you repeat that? I didn't hear what you said.
Yeah.
The Vaishnava says, no, no. One time my teacher, who was a great Vaishnava, he did so much around the world that we talked about his accomplishments. One time he got in a debate and he defeated this other person who was speaking some kind of real bogus type conceptions of life. So one of his disciples was there and he was massaging at night because he was a very old man. So the disciple was a young guy and he was seeing the priest from New York. He was seeing according to his own conceptions. And all of a sudden, he saw my frail old teacher as like the heavyweight champion of the world. You know, like he just defeated someone. So he couldn't help control himself. And he said, Prabhupada, you are the greatest. And my teacher just said, no. No. I'm just a devotee. Well, one person even said to him, oh, Prabhupada, you're such a great devotee. He said, no, devotee is not an easy thing. It's actually easy. There's no material qualification, but there's spiritual qualification. You have to be free from envy. So that's what happens. Now you're filled with love and devotion. So these are the symptoms of a bhakti. They're satisfied. And I think some of you have been coming to these kirtans have been seeing nice bhaktis. And some of these nice devotees, young people that come here, like Ananta Vichutra and Janavi, you feel there's a lack of fervor in them. I want, I want, I want, I want. You feel that when you're with them, if you've seen them. Why? Because their hearts are filled with bhakti or devotion. So that's the symptom. Now, realizing it, one becomes intoxicated, stunned, and self-blissful. Because it's not only just satisfaction. It's energy of Ladini Shakti, Krishna praying, love of Godhead. It's overwhelming. Because it's the pleasure potency of God flowing through your heart. So there are symptoms. And people have what's called bhavas, and they have overwhelming emotions from that. And it's described, and there's so many stories of great saints and the symptoms they would have in this type of consciousness when you're actually filled with divine love. Now the next section says such emotions are not worldly. So even though it's ecstatic, someone may be laughing and dancing and crying and jumping, but it's not worldly. Why? Because when your heart is filled up with that bhakti or devotion, you're free from any other desire. So it means that that's a spiritual thing. You see, so I've actually taken extensive notes on each verse, but I realize we can discuss one verse all day. So what I'm going to do now, because I kind of feel like intellectual indigestion could set. So, you know, I want you to digest. You know, the rest of the things, like tomorrow, the first session is going to be on mantra. So we're actually going to have some really nice kirtaneers. Really very pure soul. You know, he's going to come and chant with his wife and also explain a little bit about it. In fact, even my guru, really, he noted this person that he doesn't have envy. And he's a good friend of mine. He comes here sometime watching me to Shringa, and he just sits in the back because he's a very humble soul. But he actually has a lot of realization. He's going to chant. I'm going to do something with actual, share with him my own personal chakra meditations. We'll do that together. We'll continue a little bit in our about these sutras. So what we're going to do now, I really feel we need about a 10-minute break. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to teach you something called prayerful reading. How you actually read the scriptures. And then you'll practice a little bit. And then we have full morning. evening, afternoon. I got it right the third time. And then after that, we'll be free, and then we'll be at the temple. Ananta Dachuta, they're examples of bhakti and devotion. You know, and you just get a lot from them. I think most of you may know them or seen them. They're really wonderful. I'll tell you stories about them. When they were born, their mother took each of them and put them on the altar of the temple and said, "I give you to God." And you'll meet them. And you know, it's bhakti. Bhakti is dedication. They're not artificial. They are who they are. But everything's for God. And they're so attached to those deities. And if you hear their chanting, it's from this platform. See, someone may make nice music, but if he's from the platform of ego and is looking at you as an object for them, the devotion isn't here. When someone's actually in that humble position, Ananda doesn't look at the audience when he chants because he doesn't want to see them looking at him in the center, because that's not his mood. So they're exceptional. And you'll see the deities, and you'll see the amount of love by the beauty that's offered. And you'll understand how this engages those elements that can allure us into the egotistical conception. But we give them to God in the form of the deities. And it's very, very beautiful. And therefore, in bhakti, you can have sensual experience. In jnana, you can't. Why? Because you experience things out of love. If your mother cooks for you and cooks something very nice, all she needs to do is taste the grain, and she has the taste. What she's tasting is how much you enjoy it. Do you understand? She's tasting how much you enjoy it. So bhakti is full of color and fragrance and sounds, but it has a spirit of love. So you take a 10-minute break, come back at 3:05. I may keep you for 5 more minutes, then 3:30, because I need that time. And we'll do prayerful reading, and I'll teach you how to do it. And you got a 10-minute break. But please come back exactly 5:05. Joy, how are you doing? I'm so happy for you. Okay? How many students do we have here? Count, please.
13.
How many people think they can share a book?
Yeah.
You can share it? Okay, Lisa, you go over by Joy. You share a book. Okay? I think beside that we'll do this. Okay. Are you ready? I want to do something practical here. And this is called prayerful reading because in bhakti, if you're like a train and your destination is perfection, the tracks are called sadhu sangha, association with saintly people. It's described as a saintly person. It's described that your heart is like a crystal ball. And you reflect what's ever in your proximity. So if you want to advance in bhakti, you have to get sadhu sangha. You're actually fortunate in New York, believe it or not, because at least in the bhakti path, you know, there's a lot of saintly people that come here and live here, etc. Lisa and Joy are lighting up. Because they like these people and they're associated with them. What happens is you reflect. But a lot of people are isolated and also in our lives. So the way that you get that sadhu sangha is by books of good teachers. And I explain to people, if you read just to become a scholar in the modern world, it's very, very difficult. And you probably won't do it. So what I recommend to people is just 10 minutes of what's called prayerful reading. And what prayerful reading means is You approach the book, you find out who the personalities in the book that are going to be speaking. And then you begin with a prayer to change me, to impact me, to inspire me with your knowledge. And you just begin with that prayer. And then you just begin reading very slowly for a fixed period of time with absolutely no distraction. And if you do it in that way, in 10 minutes, it'll be so intense and accelerated. And what you do is you read slowly, and if something hits you, just read it out loud 3 times. Or here, just read it to yourself 3 times. When you finish, after the prescribed amount of time, which is, let's say, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, then you pay your respects, gratitude. Another additional exercise you can do is after that, you don't have to do this, it's what's called free writing. Free writing is you just have your pen move and you vow not to stop it, even if you say, I don't know what to say, I don't know what to say, I don't know what to say. Mm-hmm. But what will happen is a lot of the realizations will come. So what we're going to do now is do 10 minutes of free writing and 5 minutes of 10 minutes of reading, prayerful reading, 5 minutes of writing, which had a little more time, and then you'll break up into groups and discuss among yourselves. Because this is an essential part of spiritual life, to develop the talking and listening capacity on a higher level than what's called in Sanskrit prajalpa, idle talk. Okay? Now, this is, you take this one, this is probably best. So, you're going to be studying from my teacher, the great elevated soul. You can pray that perhaps give me something, influence me. And this is going to talk about the basic principles. We talked about sambandhagyan, metaphysical knowledge in bhakti, is that the soul is different than the body. The basic point. So let's see if we... Can anybody else think they can share reading? Or if there's even some other spiritual book around.
I'll share.
Okay, you share. Okay, let's see what we got here. I think we have enough. Okay? We'll see. And then you can keep the book, because after reading it, people generally like to read what's more. Okay. I think we'll get enough here. And we have one more? Okay, now I'll tell you when to start. I'm going to time it. Okay? You can begin. Read the first chapter. I'll give you 10 minutes. First, offer your prayers to make yourself perceptible. Say, please enlighten me, give me some spirit, some change me. What do you want to approach a teacher for? Underline if there's one particular thought that. See how in 15, 20 minutes, so much you can accelerate your learning and study in this way? Okay. Look up now. Just turn to your partners. Okay? Turn. 3 is 5. And discuss among yourselves any points that you want to share with each other. You can talk about it. What you like, what you didn't like. Okay? Okay, can you look up? You can all look up, we'll just kind of wind up and finish this up. So that's also part of bhakti. You know, you're talking about spiritual things, purifying. We talk, we don't stop talking, but you try to refine some of your discussions about spiritual things. And it's an act of devotion. So again, it has a potency. It'll bring out a more sense of devotion and love in your heart. Also give you that sambandha gyan, that foundational understanding that's important for bhakti. And it's one of the 6 loving exchanges of devotion that are practiced in the world. It's said in one book, it says, the dhati prithagrihati, among spiritualists especially, you exchange gifts. It's bhakti. You're trying to please another. It's a very nice thing, and I do that among my Vaishnava friends. You try it. There's one very, very saintly lady in Vrindavan that Brin met. I took Brin and her friend Amy into her room, and she is way elevated. And always, every week, I'm getting some kind of bookmark, calligraphy, writing, prayer, you know, and she's always doing this with people, sacred things from places. Then Guyama Dachi Prichiti, you inquire in confidence and you explain in confidence. That's also how you exhibit bhakti in the world. So this was kind of a very nice practical thing to kind of end it. I saw you enjoying so much, I think you could have continued. So I think we'll try to do this in every session at the end. You know, because and you also see how this type of studying in 15-10 minutes, how much it accelerates. Because you're not trying, it's not egotistical. You know, I'm trying to learn, I'm trying to become a scholar. It's tell me how to surrender and serve to Krishna, God better. And the other one is bhunte bhujyate jaiva. You give and accept prasad. Prasad is food that's offered to God. So we'll, and generally a Vaishnava function. Vaishnava means devotee of Vishnu. Vishnu means all-pervading, that presence of everywhere. It usually begins with, ends with prasad. So we've only taken to 3:35, even though you already had your food break. So if you could just come up, I'd like to share with you. Just come up and don't be shy, please.
We are really giving it four senses, what? Or is this a test?
What's that?
Yes, are we giving it four senses? Are we giving it four senses? Is
this
a test? Well,
I'm
honoring it, okay.
It's your relative, how much God's doing. It's actually offered. It's the person who runs the donor plant, he's a devotee of Krishna.
Really?
Yeah. And
oh, wow.
Anything that he bakes is offered to Krishna with love and devotion first. Yeah. You didn't know that.
No. I was like,